This week on the show, Super Bowl ads go bad, Congress circles Hulu, Amazon gets touchy-feely, and Adobe warns of a return to the video dark ages. Right here on This Week in Media, number 170. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. Another show is on the way. This is Alex, and I am sitting in for Daisy, even though Daisy is still on the show. How confusing. Daisy, why are we doing this?
Because we wanted to defy the time-space continuum today. But I'm in Las Vegas at the iMedia Brand Summit. I've mentioned before on the show, I do some work in conference programming for iMedia, so I played a large part in helping shape this brand summit that's going on right now. And I basically wanted to kind of jump in for a few minutes. I've got to head back to the show and take care of some of my other commitments. But I'm really super excited, after we introduce our other guests, to just share some of the things that Bob Garfield said this morning. He was our keynote speaker, and he is just the preeminent ad critic in America. He's been writing for Advertising Age for 25 years, but he also is on NPR. He has written the book The Chaos Scenario, and he is just a wonderful curmudgeon and is just known for probably having the best review of Super Bowl ads and also putting them in context. So I actually got to hear him talk this morning. So I thought after we introduce our guests, I can share a little bit of that, and then you guys can talk about other things.
Sounds great. Also, we're going to go around the table here. Another usual suspect, Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how's it going, Alex? Good to see you.
Good to have you. Good to be back. I know you've been here. I haven't been here, so it's good to be back. And then also coming in, another a repeat performance. Another we've had Brady on before. Brady Brim DeForest. Hey, Brady.
Hey, Alex. Hey, Daisy. Hey, Tim. How are you guys?
Good. Good to have you back.
Absolutely, pleasure to be here.
And so without further ado, let's go back to Daisy and have her give us a little breakdown of, because I have my own review of the Super Bowl commercials. I watched all of them.
And, well, it's the best part. Although, you know, I'm not a huge football fan, but I know people really enjoyed the game and said it was a good game as well. Interestingly, the ad that has been
it was a cute game, you know, but then let's get to the important piece, right?
Well, and the funny thing is, here I am at a marketing conference, and one of the things that we discussed yesterday was if there was a video that we need to show at some point during the Super Bowl party was, where is it going to run? Is it going to run over the ads or over the game? And of course, everybody here is most interested in the ads. The ad that's getting talked about a lot, certainly online, is the Google ad. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that one, but it's just interesting that Google even had an ad. And it kind of showed, you know, searching for, you know, restaurants in Paris. And then you have, you know, at the end, there's a baby involved, and it's a happy ad, a branding ad, which is a little bit unusual because the Google ads seem to focus on what Google is already known for, which is dominating in search, rather than focusing on what Google is really trying to be now, in addition to that, which is a media and technology company. But Bob's review of pretty much the rest of the ads was, a lot of them really fell short on the actual promise of branding. Now, take the Doritos spot. That was the spot where the guy has a choking collar. I'm sorry, the dog. It starts off with the dog, and the dog has a no bark collar on. And he wants to go up and get Doritos from this guy in the park. And the guy says, you have to speak for it. So then the dog goes behind him, he takes off the collar, he puts it on the guy, and then the guy basically is choking. And what Bob said, he goes, yeah, if you're in the snack business, you really want to get people thinking about choking to death. And he got, and it was like, yeah, you're right. Does that actually, and he said, does this make anyone even marginally hungrier for Doritos?
I will admit, though, it was pretty funny.
It was entertaining. But does it make anybody want to buy Doritos more because of it? Does it say anything about what Doritos stands for, or what they're all about?
What were you going to say, Tim?
Doritos for dogs. You know, the dog loves the Doritos. So, you know, that's what they're, you know, that was the...
What you're saying, Tim, is that they're expanding their market.
That's right. Dogs are all about Doritos now. Although I did like the other Doritos spot where the guy comes over for a date with a woman and she's a single mom. And he's like checking her out. She's walking away. And then he sees the little kid, and the little kid like grabs him and says, keep your hands off my mom and keep your hands off my Doritos.
That was That was pretty good. So no, Daisy,
see that that's probably better for a branding proposition if you think about it. And we're kind of thinking this is a Super Bowl. We're talking big branding here, but how do you really get them? It's wonderful to entertain, and there's no doubt these ads were entertaining. We were all laughing. I mean, it's kind of funny. It is kind of funny, as sick as it might be to watch a guy wearing a dog collar and get kind of choked with it. Similarly, there was the Snickers ad with Betty White basically getting knocked on her butt. I think it's hilarious when you've seen pratfall videos. Those are fantastic. But Bob's point again was, what is it about Betty White getting knocked on her ass that's going to get people to spend or to go out and buy a Snickers bar that weren't going to buy it before? And he pointed out that there was an ad from Bud for, gosh, I hope I get the name right. Is it 55? It's their, I think it's their lighter beer. And he said, you know, this is the lowest rated Budweiser ad on the ad meter. He said, but this is actually the best ad because it's a sales pitch. There are no jokes, no boobs, and no horsies in it. He goes, it was the only ad where the money spent wasn't squandered because it actually delivered. Now, this is what I thought was really interesting. He said, I'm not saying I agree, but he said, it was the only ad that delivered news to consumers who crave information. I mean, think we're in this kind of news-hungry society. We talk about Twitter and social media and how things come to us and get pushed to us, and we want information about products before we buy them, even something like beer. And he said, this was the ad that actually told you something about the product, which is kind of interesting because I don't think there's any question that a lot of these Super Bowl ads are spectacularly entertaining. And we may be talking about them, but I think there's a sense of, okay, a week from now, what sort of lift will they get in brand? And you know what? Maybe we'll all disagree, and that's okay. That's, you know, that was his point of view.
I guess the only thing I'd say about that is that I think that we're being a little two-dimensional when we talk about it that way. When you're, you know, a lot of times when you're trying to do, you know, develop a brand, you're trying to develop a feeling related to that brand, and it may not be trying to sell the actual points of whatever that is. It might be trying to get, you know, Doritos might be trying to be more edgy, more fun. You know, someone might be, you know, because like, for instance, light beer to me is just I get that they really told us what is important about it, but what they really should say is that if you want to lose weight, don't drink beer. That's a more accurate term, you know, than it's a stupid product. And so, and it, you know, tastes like water essentially. And so I'm sorry to say that, but when I saw it, all I could think of is, wow, you could make something that tastes bad already taste even worse, you know, and still get you fat. And so
tell us how you really feel about Budweiser.
It's just that one ad. I mean, so I was like, yeah, you gave us the facts. I'd rather be entertained because it's a stupid product. So if you're going to sell me a stupid product, at least make me laugh about it. Like,
but you're someone who's never going to be in the market for that. You're not somebody who's a Budweiser drinker. And yeah, that's okay. Well, that's true. I'm not really a Doritos consumer. So for me, yeah, I thought it was entertaining. I'm not any more apt to go buy Doritos because they entertain me. I don't know. It will be interesting to see if your point is valid. And I think there's definitely something to what you said, that they might be trying to position themselves as more edgy, clever, viral.
Yeah.
And that could work.
I got something out of the Snickers commercial. I mean, the idea was that if you're hungry, you feel like Betty White or Abe Vigoda. And if you eat a Snickers, that gives you a little bit more energy to go play football.
Well, there's that, you know, what were your favorite ads? What were your favorite ads? Who saw the ads? Tim, was that your favorite ad? What was your favorite ad from the,
I'd say it is a toss up between those two, between the Doritos where the guy comes over to take the woman
that was
out.
Pretty good.
I really like that one. And I like the Betty White, Abe Vigoda, football one. And I'm blanking on the other one. There was one more that I thought was pretty good, and I guess it wasn't that good of a commercial because I don't remember it.
Brady?
I think there's an interesting case study if you look at the last 5 years of the Super Bowl.
The downward spiral?
Definitely this year, as Daisy said, most of the ads were focused on conversion and less brand lift and positioning. But the one case study I think is interesting to come back to, you know, 5 years later, after their very first, Super Bowl commercial, is GoDaddy. And, you know, taste-wise, I'm not a big fan. I think they're a little bit, high potential to offend. But what GoDaddy does really well is they convert the viewing audience on television into views on their site. And they do that by giving folks just a very small taste of, you know, what purports to be a full, you know, experience online. Last year, they actually had an ad that showed folks watching the Super Bowl and then literally going in their living room to their computer and tuning into GoDaddy.com. And this year, they did a similar thing. They gave folks a small, you know, a little bit of foreshadowing as to what they'd find in the commercial itself. And if you look at the numbers that they do during the game, I mean, it's something like 1.5 million uniques on right. GoDaddy.com just during the Super Bowl, which is pretty wild. So, you know, in terms of conversion, they do an incredible job at actually converting, you know, viewers on TV to you know, potential customers online.
I think we did. I think that we saw more. Didn't we see more attempts at least to connect stuff online? I think wasn't there one with the vacation crew? You know, Chevy Chase was that? Is that
part? Yeah. There's actually, Will Richmond of Video News did a recap on that this morning on specifically how many were tagged with URLs. And he said, of the 58 ads that ran during the game last night, 38 of them were tagged with a URL and 20 were not. On a percentage basis, that's about equal to last year when 37 of the 56 ads carried a URL. And then he said, of the ads this year with a call to go to the website, only 4 of them explicitly urged the viewer to see more or right. watch more at the website, which is interesting. You can just tag it with your site, but you're not saying that there's more there. And so, and the ones who did that were focused on the family, Boost Mobile, GoDaddy, and Home Away. That's the Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo one, to your point, Alex. So it's interesting. And, you know, Brady, you bring up an interesting thing about GoDaddy. I mean, think about it. This is a company that has become probably the best known web domain registration site. And I think a lot of that is because we all remember what they did 5 years ago with the first Super Bowl ad and how they continued to use it. That's, you know, that's a company that has actually, that has really, you know, vaulted up to be in sort of the popular consumer consciousness because of the Super Bowl. So that's an interesting one.
Well, I feel like and I could be wrong because I don't know. I probably don't watch enough TV, but I feel like there really isn't that. GoDaddy's advertising on TV is really the only time I can think of it is during the Super Bowl. The rest of the time, it's heavily on online video, online media, online whatever. But it's the only time they really crest into the into TV is during the Super Bowl. So they're really focusing all their ad dollars on that. And I think to what Brady was saying is that they very effectively move that audience around.
Well, and I think in addition, they're also very good about using the Super Bowl as a publicity opportunity as well. Right. They create advertising that, you know, they buy the spot, they book the spot with the network, and then they create advertising that, you know, can't be run. And then they take this, you know, the subsequent scandal, and they use that to their advantage as well. So they actually end up shooting 4 or 5 Super Bowl commercials. And they put one, you know, eventually that's approved by the network on TV, and then the others, you know, are online. But they've actually built in this great viral tool because, you know, everyone wants to see something that's been censored or banned. And it's an interesting way of approaching it as well.
Now, Daisy, what was your favorite? Did you have a favorite? Did you watch
it? Well, my favorite was actually a banned Super Bowl ad. If you guys get a chance to see it, it was for KGB, which I think is an online information service. I'm not sure it was ever actually intended to really be submitted to CBS for consideration. Mm-hmm. But there's some great banned Super Bowl ads on YouTube. And it basically had these two wives at a golf course talking about their husbands and complaining that both of them had their heads up their, I guess I've already said it once on the show, so I could say it again. Their heads up their asses. And they actually had this hilarious visual. You guys have to, it's one of the funniest ads I've seen just for, I mean, it's ridiculous. You've got to see it because we all use that phrase every now and then.
It's a visual form of that.
Yes, and it's just, so go check it out. Google that, you know, banned Super Bowl ad KGB. And that, I hope we'll have everybody laughing.
I think the one that I was left, I don't know why, I thought it was funny when I saw it, and then I watched it again online, and it was, I don't know, I think it's also my generation, or when I was alive. But did you see the Sonata ad with the stuffed animals?
Yeah, that was great.
So they took, and I had one of those little monkeys. They had this little gray monkey. It's like the little stuffed gray monkey with the long arms and the long little tail. And it's a bunch of, it's these toys that are all out sporting, you know, but there was something about watching a scene of this stuffed monkey doing a little, riding one of those motors, you know, whatever they call them, ski thing, you know, like it's a water
jet ski.
He's doing a, there's this little stuffed monkey doing a flip with a jet ski. And I don't know why that I thought that was so funny, but it was, for me, that was that just that one scene was worth, you know, the Super Bowl ads. But I think overall, I think the Super Bowl ads were the worst round of Super Bowl ads I think I've seen, since I started paying attention to Super Bowl ads. You know, I mean, would you guys, did you guys think that they, it seemed like a really, I watched them all this morning because I only saw, I arrived from Seychelles in the middle of the day yesterday, or in the middle of the game or third quarter or something. So I missed most
of the
poor
guy.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I'd been out of the loop, for a quite some time. And so, so I missed most of the game and I, watched them all on CBS, whatever, you know, the CBS news, CBS Sports, you know, has all of them. You can just go up there and watch them all. I guess you can watch them all on YouTube too. Are they, do they have their own section on YouTube?
They do.
Yeah. So that's when I got to see them and it was still just as funny. Anyway, anything else?
I thought the Boost Mobile one with old football players was just horrific.
Oh my gosh. That was so ugly. That was like watching a car accident slowly.
Yeah. It was just like, it's not even like hip. It's so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a pretty rough one. The Brett Favre one.
I guess 3 million doesn't get you what it used to, right?
Yeah.
Sadly enough.
Yeah. So any other big stats, Daisy, about those ads?
That's all I've got so far. I think the call to action, the URL stuff is really important. I mean, especially because I'm preaching to the choir here, but so much of the interaction that we have when we put on our consumer hats with brands are on the web. We learn more about them on the web. We go to research products more than we ever have in the past. So I really think that smart brands will use a big branding opportunity like the Super Bowl as a starting point. I mean, Doritos, which got us talking, it would be great if they had some, you know, sort of, I mean, Doritos has been terrific with having great user-generated contest for ads. It'd be great if there's, you know, just some kind of very clever call to action to their website, some way that you can really truly, you know, interact with the brand, even if it's something like ask Doritos a question live on Twitter right now and we'll answer in the next half hour after the Super Bowl or something. I mean, it could be goofy, but I think that that is really, you know, I mean, and that sort of fits in with some of the things we're talking about here at the summit. It's just the increasing role that we as consumers and customers are playing in helping define a brand and what they're all about is that you really have to let people have a voice. So I think the ads that open up a dialogue and give viewers an opportunity to come back and talk more are probably going to be the ones that have the most lasting value in terms of purchases.
Now, again, our the IRC chat who's watching the stuff. By the way, if you are hearing this podcast, you should always know that you can go to irc.twit.tv to interact with us live while we're doing the live show. If you're watching the stream, and people are asking us about the Green Police ad. So, what did you guys think of the Green Police ad? Did you like it?
I liked it, except for the fact that it was for a diesel car.
Well, but those you know, those new clean diesels are very clean. They have no emissions, like zero.
And diesel fuel getting it dispensed to your car creates no carbon emissions at all. I mean, the trucks that deliver it, they all run on solar power. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's a clean diesel. They're positioning it. So
just like clean coal. Mm-hmm. Yep, it's all clean. It's
clean. Clean coal. Clean, I like that, Tim. Clean.
Yep, love it.
I think that the problem is that for a lot of people watching the Super Bowl, I think that there's a cross section of the people watching the Super Bowl that would be terrified by that ad, going, "Yeah, that's the future." You know, like they wouldn't be caught up with the whole. I mean, that to me, the I could just see lots of people that I know in Middle America just going, "Yeah, that's what they're going to try to do to us. This is the slippery slope, and that's where it ends." And you know, I'm never buying one of those cars again. You know, I mean, I think that was the dangerous part.
I want my money, my guns, and my freedom. You can keep the change.
Well, I mean, you know, I just there's a lot of people who complain about that, and that would be the only issue. So you got to be careful about it. Brand. I guess Audi has decided that's not an important segment of the market for what they're trying to hit. So I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you just have to go after the exact market and hope you're not damaging it in other areas. So, Daisy, anything else from Vegas?
No, I'm going to say goodbye and thank you for letting me be on the show today. And I will see you guys next week. Have a great chat.
All right. Thanks, Daisy.
Thanks. And thanks, Daisy. Always
bet red. Put two on red.
So our next story here with Comcast and NBC. So this is Boxy. So Zucker is gets confronted about Hulu's Boxy block. So this was during the House Energy and Commerce Committee's subcommittee on communications technology and the internet. NBC Universal CEO Jeff Zucker and Comcast chairman and CEO Brian Roberts were asked point blank by the subcommittee chair Rick Boucher about Hulu's efforts to block Boxy from carrying its programming. Their response was, we have many distributors of Hulu content that we have legal distribution deals with, so we don't preclude distribution deals, answered Zucker. He was saying that, you know, they just don't have a deal with Boxy. So, Tim, do you think this is a valid response?
Sounds like a skirt around the issue. I don't think they've tried to get a deal with Boxy. I mean, I don't know the inside, but I think it's great that Congress is getting involved. I don't like regulations, but I think that this is a case where we've got new technology and we need to pay attention to what's going on. Else we could be sold up the river again, just like we don't have mass transit in LA. There's a reason why we don't have a train that goes all the way to the airport. Seems kind of dumb. Other cities have a train that goes all the way to the airport, but ours stops a little ways away. You have to get off and take a bus. Well, crazy stuff like that happens.
Well, I mean, and I mean, the crazy thing about LA, I mean, I know this is a little off, but I think it is to your point, is that, you know, LA was probably the best mass transit at the turn of the 19th century, or the, you know, the turn of the 1900s. In the early 1900s, it was the best mass transit in the world, and Roger the market Abbott destroyed it on purpose. What?
Roger Rabbit came along and closed it up.
I don't know if it's Roger Rabbit. But the point is that there is something we have to pay attention to in this area. I think that there is a concept that the market should be able to take care of itself, but sometimes the market can, you know, create the 405.
Yes.
I don't think I have to say anything else. Go ahead, Brady.
I actually have a slightly different take on it. I mean, I love Vox. I love what Avner is doing. But I do know that Jason and his team at Hulu are under a lot of pressure from, you know, the companies, the studios, the networks that they license content from, to keep Hulu off of the television. And, you know, so in order to save their own skin and, you know, to allow them to continue to push the boundaries online with Hulu, I think it's, you know, an unfortunate side effect that they're going to have to roll over when they're, you know, when the folks they answer to at the networks who own them, you know, say, hey, we can't have Hulu on the TV. I don't think that you know, Hulu wanted to actually take that step. I think it was definitely pressure from folks like Zucker, you know, at NBC and Fox and ABC that are you know, having to deal with the realities of licensing.
Well, isn't this always the challenge when you get into this situation? You have, you know, the old media or any old industry always has this problem where you want to take full advantage of the new industry and you have a leader position. You could dominate the new industry, but the question is do you dominate it at the detriment of the one you already have? I mean, isn't that the challenge, that the fence that they're trying to straddle?
Of course, but there's also the financial reality. I mean, most of these shows on Hulu are, you know, SAG or AFTRA, depending on which show they are. So they're, and all the other guilds as well. I mean, that's the nature of Hollywood. There's a lot of bureaucracy. So, you know, the ability to distribute content via broadband has a very different cost structure than it is to put it back onto a television. And because a lot of these definitions are fairly blurry still, it's, you know, much safer to not take the risk, especially from a financial standpoint, than it is to push content onto the TV and end up, you know, owing, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in residual payments to, you know, talent that performed in these shows. And that's the reality, that these definitions aren't clear. They're not, you know, the SAG New Media Agreement, for instance, won't expire until 2011. That's the next time it's going to be, you know, renegotiated. So there's a lot of gray area, and there's not a high tolerance for risk, I think, because there isn't necessarily, you know, the dollars to back it up yet. I think when the money really starts flowing, then there's going to be a much larger risks taken. But right now, just everyone's playing it safe.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Also in the news, Amazon acquires a touchscreen maker for the future Kindle project. So this is Amazon has purchased touchscreen startup TouchCo, with plans to incorporate it into Kindle's hardware division. So this is according to the New York Times, reports that Amazon has acquired the New York-based TouchCo, a small startup specializing in touchscreen technology. The company's interpolating force-sensitive resistance technology allows for flexible, transparent, pressure-sensitive touchscreens that could cost as little as $10 a square foot, which is, you know, a fraction of what people are paying right now. And so, and they, you know, they're a lot more, the stuff that you see on the iPhone or the iPod Touch or the iPad are a lot more expensive and cannot detect an unlimited number of simultaneous touch points like TouchCo's technology. So it's interesting that, you know, that they're not licensing the technology, you know, from TouchCo. They just bought them to, I guess, essentially to make sure that no one else can have it at the same time. Do you think they're going to aggressively try to move towards, and this is for you, Tim, do you think that you'll see that the Kindle, them trying to move it towards the iPad, trying to compete directly?
Well, if you'd asked me last week before the story came out, I'd say that they were going to do a technology play and just have their technology licensed in other devices. But now that they've done this, it seems to, send a signal that, yeah, they're in it for the fight. And they're going to keep that Kindle going.
Brady, do you think that they can compete with the iPad effectively?
Well, Amazon is not a hardware company, and competing against Apple on hardware is going to be very difficult for them. I don't think they have the economies of scale yet in terms of distribution for the Kindle. I think to making an aggressive step forward to compete on the touchscreen side, I think is really important for them. I've used a Kindle plenty of times and comparing the hardware buttons to the software touchscreen on the iPad or an iPhone, there's a huge difference. And so I think for them to compete effectively, feature-wise, it's going to be really important for them. And when you look at the Amazon Kindle lineup, the fact that the high-end Kindle only costs $10 less than the iPad, I think it's going to be a real point of differentiation for the iPad. It makes the iPad that much more reasonable, comparatively. Apple, has a major advantage. They can undercut almost everyone because they can lock up, touchscreen supplies, and they have in Asia. It's very difficult to go out and to have someone manufacture a touchscreen for you right now because Apple essentially has a monopoly on the supply chain. So for Amazon to compete, they almost had to go out and buy a company like this in order to, one, offer it, some kind of differentiating feature in their product, but two, to actually be able to, to obtain, enough hardware to supply, what looks like, a touchscreen Kindle.
Well, it definitely looks like they're definitely not giving up. I mean, the thing is that they wouldn't be spending this kind
of
money.
Good for them.
Yeah. No, I think it's great for us. I think it's great for the market. I think that it's important that they don't give up. And we just saw an iSlate, I think, was released or announced, I think, over the last couple of days by an English firm. And so, I'm very excited to see. That's going to be Windows 7 based, and I'm very excited to see. It looks very similar to the iPad, and it's good. I mean, I think that Apple continues to need to be pushed because I think that Apple, left to their own devices, I mean, they do things that are very revolutionary to start. Sometimes I feel like they don't move fast enough, when they aren't getting pressed. And we're already seeing the effects of the competition, not necessarily that's good for the consumer, but good for the book industry, where the prices are now going up a little bit, right? Amazon's no longer able to push everybody to $9.99.
Yeah, but I do think the fact is the book business has had, this wonderful thing called hardbacks for many years, and that's where they get most of their profit from a book launch is really that initial hardback window.
Right.
And I think it's going to be hard to justify an increased price.
Do you guys buy hardbacks?
Occasionally, if I'm in an airport and it's not available as an audio book,
right,
I'll pick one up if, I'm like, okay, I'm stuck on the plane, I need something to read. Audiobooks are where it's at, man.
Yeah. Well, no, the reason I asked specifically around that is because I, whether I'm buying a book or not is one, that's a whole other question because I generally only read stuff. But Man, I find hardbacks to be just annoying because it's just so much more to carry around. And I guess that in an old model, when people said, I really want this book and I really want it part of my library, it made sense to, you know, buy a hardback book. But I don't buy them specifically because I get frustrated that I have to wait for the paperback because I don't want to buy the hardback because it's just more that I have to carry with me. And I guess I think of books as needing to be portable, which is also why I was excited about the Kindle, never actually got one. And now I'm very excited about the iPad whenever it eventually starts shipping. So now, speaking of the iPad and speaking of competition and other issues, this is from Adobe CTO Kevin Lynch, defends Flash, warns that HTML5 will throw the web, quote unquote, back to the dark ages of video. So this is what I thought was pretty pretty heavy handed, but it is. The issue is, of course, is that Apple still isn't supporting, Flash on the iPad or its iPhone. Steve Jobs calls it buggy and crash prone and dismisses Adobe as being lazy. Adobe is trying to fight the negative vibes that are emanating from Cupertino and elsewhere. It has already pointed out that it will be easy to convert Flash apps into iPad apps. Kind of, by the way. I mean, they've been talking about that with the iPhone stuff, and the stuff I've seen isn't that compelling. In a blog post today, Lynch addresses the two major threats to Flash: Apple's refusal to support it on the mobile touchscreen devices, and the rise of HTML5 as a new open standard. And he said, "We are ready to enable Flash in the browser on devices." This is for Apple stuff. If and when Apple chooses to allow it for its users, but to date, we have not had the required cooperation from Apple. Now, the first question is that will this send the first question here is will it send web video back to the dark ages? Brady, what do you think? Is it that bad? Is that apocalyptic?
No, I mean, honestly, on the desktop, Flash isn't going away. It has an incredibly high install base, both on Windows and on Mac, and so it's not disappearing. Certainly, YouTube and their adoption of H.264 and HTML5 to deliver video is a huge advantage for Apple. And they obviously worked really closely with Google to make that function in the YouTube app on the iPhone. I really think that Flash, because Adobe has had the dominant position in the marketplace for the last 10 years, in video hasn't had to innovate. They haven't had to push the envelope, and so you see a lot of people that are biting on their heels. One of those is Microsoft with Silverlight, which is
I think
more
superior.
Stable.
Absolutely,
it's way more stable. It's superior in terms of its feature set, so hopefully Adobe is going to actually take this as an opportunity to push forward with Flash. And their strategy has been that it is a platform, and Flash is a platform. Is way too cumbersome because they want it to be a universal experience across Mac, PC, Windows, Mac, PC, or mobile. It means they have a lot of useless kind of clutter inside of the Flash stack. Similar to the way that Java never really caught on because it was trying to be everything to everyone. And so if they were to use Flash really to strip it out and make it specific to video, then I think it could really be a real viable option. But right now it's just too cumbersome and too heavy for it to work on these smaller devices with slower processors and less physical memory. It just doesn't seem to work. And I mean, you can get Flash working on an iPhone. You can unlock your iPhone. There are ways to do it, but it just doesn't work. The iPhone doesn't process Flash that well, and the iPad probably won't either. So Apple's throwing its weight around, and it's either going to force Adobe to innovate, or it's going to kill Flash. But yeah. I don't think it's going to spell the end of video on the internet.
Tim, do you think that the web needs Flash?
Oh, we're going back to the dark ages without it, let me tell you. HTML5, we're going to be looking at little teeny tiny postage stamp size. No. Here's what's going on. Kevin, I interviewed Kevin for my blog back in November. At the new TV video conference they had in San Francisco. And he said back then that Flash would work on an iPhone, that he's had it ready to work on an iPhone for a long time. Now, he besides being the CTO, I think he's also the inventor of Flash. Right. So I think his feelings were hurt here a little bit. But when you look at what Apple is doing with QuickTime and with HTML5 and companies like one of my sponsors, disclosure here, MDialog has an advertising delivery system that you can dynamically insert ads on your video in the iPhone and soon to be on the iPad. And they use the Apple Adaptive Streaming to do that. And in the past, for like all of us podcasters, the problem with QuickTime was that they couldn't tell if the ad had been delivered. And that's how Flash really got a hold on the marketplace, was that with Flash, you could tell once the ad was dynamically served, you could tell if it was there. It wasn't a download that was just waiting. But with this new adaptive streaming, everything's broken up into like 8 and 10 second clips. And they're put at different bit rates, and they're available. And so depending on if you're watching it on your computer, you're watching it on an iPhone, or you're watching it on an iPad, and depending on what your connection speed is, it shifts to send that next 8 seconds or that next 10 seconds based upon what it knows your connection is. And then anywhere in those 8 or 10 seconds, they can insert an ad, or from an interactive storytelling point, you can put in a different branch of the interactive story, which that's kind of exciting.
Well, and I think from a straight video perspective, I think the hard part is there are so many other things that Flash does. When you're looking at Flash, or you're looking at Flex, or you're looking at, you know, there's a lot of really powerful tools that, and a lot of powerful platforms that Adobe's built. I think that it is a big challenge, though, is whether, you know, Apple's going to let it happen. I mean, Apple, I don't think any of this is a technical issue. I mean, in my opinion, I think that we're really talking about Apple doesn't like proprietary formats that they don't control, you know, and they have no reason. Would you, sorry, Brady?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just agreeing with you. Apple wants to control the entire technology
or they stack. want it to be either open, or they want it to be, if they can't control it, they want it to be open. And if they, you know, and so the issue is, I think that's their biggest issue, you know, with Flash. And as a result, I don't think that it doesn't, there's nothing technically that Adobe could do to get Apple to support Flash. In my opinion, the only way they can do it is for Apple to have trouble in the market and feel like adding Flash was going to give them a competitive advantage or increase their market or whatever. And I just don't see, like when we talked about when the iPhone came out, you know, people said, oh, well, eventually the iPhone's going to support Flash. And my argument was always that, yeah, it'll support Flash if Apple doesn't do well, if the launch doesn't do well, if they're on the outside trying to get in. But once Apple is in the center, you know, and the iPad, we don't know yet. But I think that if the iPad does as well as the iPhone does, I think that number one is, I think that it's a challenge. I don't think Apple needs to add Flash to it. Number two is, I think it really is more frightening for Adobe. I mean, you know, I think that this starts to become another nail in the coffin of Flash, because it's just, you know, along with Google not wanting Flash to be, I think Google and Apple in some ways feel like they're not, I mean, I don't think they're really conspiring, but both of them are obviously not interested in continuing to expand the Flash market. Do you disagree with me? Do you think that we'll ever get Flash on an iPad or an iPhone? Do you think that'll happen?
Only if the iPad fails.
Yeah. Where you feel like you need to actually, you know, put it together. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's going to boil down to, you know, people want to deliver their content where they can make money off of it. And right now, a lot of people are making money off of Flash, but they also know that they need to make money off the iPhone, and you can't make money with Flash on the iPhone. And if you can't make money there and you can't make money on the iPad, chances are you're going to, you know, buy into this technology to deliver your video ads on the iPhone and the iPad.
Right. I mean, and I think I've talked about it, so I won't talk about it too much. But the, you know, there are companies who are changing their whole web page development because they, you know, somebody that leads the company wants to make sure that they can play it on their iPhone. You know, and then I think that as you see that becomes a decision factor of, you know, you have CEOs with iPhones who can't get to their own website. And that's a, you know, that becomes a big challenge related to that. So
I think the other reality is that Apple has done a remarkable job of creating scarcity artificially by building closed marketplaces.
Yeah.
If you look at like what Red Hat did with their open source application marketplace, which really was a you know, an unequivocal failure, it was because if you can go outside of a marketplace directly to the vendor, you're going to cut out a middleman, and you're going to see, you know, substantial cost savings. Apple creates a monopoly, you know, by building a marketplace that works specifically with their technology stack, which no one else can, you know, can take a piece of, then they make all the rules. And so as long as the App Store or, you know, the iTunes Store remains a closed system, then Apple holds all the cards, because guess what? It's a wonderful delivery mechanism.
Well, and I
think it's going right into, go ahead.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing as we go down the path is when you look at development, when you look at the iTunes LP and movie extras and everything else, and then you also look at New York Times, for instance, is going to be developing a custom application to run on the iPad to make everything to take full advantage of the iPad. They're no longer worried about standardization. They're not, you know, this, whatever this app is, it's not going to be built to run on six different browsers. It's not going to be built to run on desktop and mobile. It's going to be built to run on the iPad. And if Apple is able to persuade a lot of people to start doing this and it starts to become successful for them, then you get into a really interesting thing where people aren't, you know, they might leave the heavy development away from, you know, the web is just something that they continue to output to. But the really sexy look for any of those, because they might be able to charge more for it, are applications that sit on the, you know, on the iPhone or on the iPad. But it gets right to your point, which is that it becomes a custom solution that only works when you're dealing with an Apple device. You know, it ties people back in.
And I think actually, you know, in the long term, it's very dangerous. You know, the foundation of the internet is built around open exchange of content, and, you know, portable, you know, standards that you know are interoperable. And, you know, my work with data portability and the Open Web Foundation, that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. But I think even you know more you know sinister here, you know, to go that direction for a minute, when you have one company that controls the entire technology stack, that control the marketplace, the possibility for censorship to become a reality, you know, it actually is, you know, unfortunately, totally possible. If, you know, the New York Times publishes a story that, you know, either libel or slander or something, or even, you know, maybe more realistically, a smaller publication, and, you know, there's a suit brought against Apple, what's Apple going to do? Are they going to stand up and fight for, you know, for our freedom of speech? Or are they going to just roll over and take down that offending content? And as a for-profit entity, you know, that's more concerned, I think, with protecting its position in the marketplace and protecting its, you know, its, you know, application stack, you know, I'm sure that they're probably going to roll over more cases than not. And that's a very frightening position to be in. If they really become the dominant, you know, news and media provider, then that means that Apple essentially, you know, will be in this incredible position, this frightening position to control, you know, what's communicated across their network. And that's a very frightening prospect.
Well, I definitely think that one of the things that Apple is going to is it's approaching, and they're not there yet. But if the iPad is as successful as the iPhone, I think Apple really starts to move, and this marketplace and everything else that they're creating, you're really starting to talk about antitrust issues that Apple is going to get themselves into, because it's going to be an antitrust conversation. Because I think that you are getting to a point where, you know, especially as you merge all of these medias together, when, you know, it's no longer books in one place, radio in another, TV in another, you know, and all of that is being, you know, going through a single device, then it doesn't have to necessarily, you know, and that device may, you know, maybe something like an iPad. I think that the biggest thing for me is when I look at it, I've talked to a lot of people that are thinking about getting iPads for their parents and for their kids. You know, it's the perfect non-technical device to acquire media. And I think that the issue is that if people, the actual user doesn't really, I don't want to say unsophisticated, but the person who just wants to turn the key and have their computer work and be able to surf the net, check their email, watch video, you know, so on and so forth. The issue is they don't really care about censorship. You know, they don't care about, you know, they don't care about a lot of these details. They just want it to be easy and they just want to be able to watch it. And Tim, do you think this poses a real danger?
I do and I don't. It's great that this puts the genie back in the bottle when it comes to getting people to pay for content. And that hopefully will keep us alive so that we can create, you know, high quality programming that people will pay for. But I do hear what you're saying. And in the same breath, I think there is Google, there is Microsoft, and there's Amazon. So I think those keep that open. As long as there's other content devices out there that, you know, will allow the New York Times to put their app on their device, I think that's great. It creates a marketplace. Mm-hmm. You know, you buy DVDs from Target, Walmart. It doesn't matter where you buy the DVD. You just buy it. You don't steal it. And I think that's important.
Yeah. Interesting. Also, in the in this whole argument, this is you know, YouTube is now has an opt-in experiment for HTML5. I believe it's YouTube youtube.com/HTML5, and this is a way for you to you know, check it out and see if you like the HTML5 solution. So definitely YouTube kind of moving that direction, and I think that once again is kind of an affront to the you know, to the standard Flash setup. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Now we are running out of time. I'm in the middle of a broadcast box here. So Brady, where can people find you?
You can check us out at www.tubefilter.tv or my personal blog at www.brimdeforest.com.
And Tim, where can people find you?
You can check out my blog at 1timstreet.com.
Great. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.